From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is COVID-19, its fallout, and how to best tackle it. We'll take a look at California's record unemployment levels as the state moves deeper into shutdown mode. Also, why the coronavirus is hitting some communities harder than others and how long it might take to recover. But first, the state of California is switching up how it addresses the issue of testing for COVID-19. Here's the state's top health official, Dr. Mark Galley, and what he had to say about the goals of the new plan.
As we see outbreaks across our state, whether that's in some of our essential businesses, within some of our own households, within communities, we need those test results more immediate so that we can do the correct things as relates to isolation and quarantine so we can suppress transmission.
Now, the revamp will focus testing on those in hospitals or considered at high risk of infection. Galley says there's now a four-tier priority system for testing. Those hospitalized with COVID-19 symptoms top the list along with close contacts of those with the infections. Next in line are those living in high-risk facilities, you know, like nursing homes, prisons, and homeless shelters, along with healthcare and emergency service workers. We have two of the area's top experts in this area joining us this morning to get a better handle on the current testing situation and plans for moving forward. First up is Dr. Peter Bielenson, a familiar name to you by now. He heads up Sacramento County's Department of Health Services and oversees the local COVID-19 testing efforts. And Doctor, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
I should mention, if you have questions for Dr. Bielenson or any of our guests today, use the hashtag AskInsight on Twitter, and we'll do our best to incorporate your voice into the show. Doctor, did the state reach out to you or other health directors for guidance when creating this new testing plan?
They've been talking with us generally over the last week or so. So, yes, they've been collaborating.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on the changes? Is this the direction that you were hoping it would go?
Well, I think some of it is in the direction that we would hope it would go. There's an additional tier that I think is actually third or fourth tier, which should potentially be higher up. And that is asymptomatic people people without symptoms need to be tested because they are particularly because they tend to be younger, don't have symptoms. And if they have the disease, if they have the infection, they can pass it on in what's called a super spreader manner. So I think it's important to make sure we continue to test those who are asymptomatic as well as those who are symptomatic.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that goes into, I guess that falls into the category of, are there enough tests to do that?
Right.
I did a, go ahead.
So we're at 150,000 tests now in Sacramento County. Some of them are duplicative of, you know, some people have been tested more than once, obviously, but that's about 10% of our population, which is a pretty good number. Mm-hmm. We do have, hopefully coming online in the next couple weeks, a new lab that'll allow us to go to 10 centers of community-based sites compared to the 5 that we currently have. So that may allow us, and those sites have been testing asymptomatic as well as symptomatic patients. So I'm hopeful that we'll have more available in the next couple of weeks.
How does the county organize with like Project Baseline that was working out of CalExpo and then these community sites? What's the county's role in that?
So the county's role, the only one that we don't have a huge role in is the well, actually, we do now. We've taken over a lot of the work of Verily, which is the CalExpo drive-through. That's about 400 people a day, and we are mainly running that. We also run the 5 community-based sites, as well as St. Paul's Church, and we will be running the 5 additional sites that we'll be getting up and going in another couple of weeks, assuming we get this deal with the lab. So we run most of the public testing. Then there's a lot of private testing that's going on in doctor's offices and Kaiser, et cetera, et cetera.
Doctor, you mentioned the asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people out there. And I did a super informal Twitter poll after the state's announcement. And I asked people about their COVID testing experiences. And about half said that they don't plan to get tested. And I imagine those would be the people that fall into that exact category. Is there messaging the county can put out to explain to people that don't have symptoms, why it's important to get tested?
Yeah, so it's actually more important now than it was a few weeks ago, and that is because the vast majority of new cases are people under 49, and they're about 70%, in fact, are under 49, and about 60% are under 40. So those are the people who are more likely to, if they are infected, to be asymptomatic or at least mildly symptomatic and therefore potentially be spreaders, not just to others of their age, but their senior friends and colleagues and family, as well as those with underlying conditions. So it's particularly important. And we've been trying to get the message across through the media, but we'll continue to do that through social media and flyers and multilingual efforts as well.
And we know that that spread happens a lot at house gatherings, house parties. Does the county plan to explicitly put a cap on attendance or even prohibit them?
Yeah, so we've been talking about that with the state. The state actually has sort of mushy language, if you will, about the outdoor gatherings, and we want to put more specific information about that. So we're seriously considering that. But I should point out that it's not just the gatherings now. There are a large number of people, particularly migrant workers and day workers, who are being infected now. And they're obviously are providing services to folks that need them. But at the same time, they can't afford to necessarily take time off. So it's hard to get those folks to quarantine when they get infected.
Doctor, yesterday we spoke about whether school districts will continue with 100% or mostly distance learning when classes start up in the coming weeks. Will the county be issuing any guidance for the local districts?
Yeah, we've been working with the local school districts, all 13 of the school districts and Sacramento County Office of Education, led by Dave Gordon. We've been collaborating literally daily with them, and I think there'll be an announcement in the next day or two.
Mm-hmm. How will the county now work under these new guidelines? What does the county have to change to coincide with how the state wants us to roll out going forward?
The testing guidelines?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so these are guidelines. I think we'll continue to make sure that we try and test as many people as possible, both asymptomatic and symptomatic. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do enough with the resources that we have.
What are your numbers showing in terms of availability to get a test and then turnaround time? We hear greatly varying numbers from, those quick turn tests that take about a half an hour, I guess, at your doctor's office, to ones that really become ineffective because, you plan for the test. That might take several days. Then you get the test, and it can be a week or more before you get the results. And since it's a snapshot in time, it doesn't really do much good.
Right. Very definitely the case. So up until now, we've had decent access to the tests, but most of them, including through doctor's offices, go through Quest or LabCorp, the national commercial laboratories. And they are taking 8 to 9 days, and I've heard of 11 to 12 days to get turnaround, which, as you were pointing out, if you just get tested, let's say 2 days after you were infected, and then you add the 12 days, that's 14 days before you hear. And it's, as everybody knows by now, that's the time it takes to isolate. So it's totally irrelevant by the time you get the test result back.
Right.
So the issue is getting the tests back more quickly. And that's where we're working with this laboratory company. It's a local laboratory company that we're hopeful will be able to have 48-hour turnaround.
Wow, that would be great. Yeah, because unless you're going into, complete isolation after you get the test, it really doesn't do much good if all that time passes. So.
Right.
All right, Dr. Peter Bielenson, Director of Sacramento County's Department of Health Services. Always appreciate your time here on the show. Thank you.
Sure.
And we are discussing the state's new testing plans for controlling the spread of COVID-19 in California. And one person who is a great resource on this subject is Dr. Brad Pollack. He's the Associate Dean for Public Health Services at the UC Davis School of Medicine. And Dr. Pollack, it's great to speak with you again.
Thanks, Randall. Nice to be here with you and Peter.
Yeah. So months ago, I spoke with you in a conversation that wasn't broadcast because I was trying to wrap my head around the difference between the type of testing we just spoke about with Dr. Bielenson, and you know, that moment in time COVID-19 testing, and then the serum or antibody testing that shows whether someone has had the disease previously. And then just based on my own conversations with family and friends, I know there are still people out there that either don't know that there's two different types of tests or don't understand the differences between them. So you're an expert in this area. Can you give us a real simple explainer on this?
Yeah, the antibody tests, while they have some useful purposes, including sort of characterizing, you know, how much of the population has been exposed or infected, they really don't help at the individual level. They don't help contain the epidemic whatsoever. So it's really the viral PCR RNA test. That's the one that detects the actual presence of the virus at the time the test is done.
This is the swab in the nose. That are needed.
Yeah, the swab in the nose. There are some other tests are being developed now that may compete with that, but they essentially look at virus present when they do the test. And that's going to be the absolute necessary information to be able to get somebody into isolation or quarantine. So that's really kind of the key driver right now, is having these viral tests available and having them available appropriately. And if you recall, I guess about a month and a half ago when I was on Insight, you know, we had a discussion about testing strategies. And at the time, and I still believe this, Dr. David Lebarski and I, David's the Vice Chancellor of Human Health Sciences and the CEO of UC Davis Health, we actually put out a little paper that talked about this sort of massive general asymptomatic testing in the population versus doing more targeted testing. And as the as the supply chain has dried up to be able to do these tests freely, now we're moving more toward a strategy of doing targeted testing.
Which is what the state is calling for.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, to emphasize Peter's points also, you know, one of the key things is having those tests available for folks that need to be tested right away. And if you're doing contact tracing, for example, you need to be able to reach out to folks quickly and try to identify people that were possibly exposed, and then test them, test the folks that have come to attention. But having that rapid turnaround of testing is really critical to sort of to contain the epidemic now. So that's really kind of the key thing right now. We don't have enough testing capacity. One of the reasons right now, it's not for the state lacking in this. I mean, we've gone from doing, you know, a couple months ago, 20,000 tests a day to 100,000 a day. But the problem right now is that the supply chain for some of the things that are needed to do the test, the reagents, the chemicals that are used for the tests, the swabs that are used to collect the samples, and even the media in which the swabs are placed to preserve it enough to be able to get tested, these are in short supply, and the supply chain has been disrupted. So now we're moving much more toward a targeted testing strategy, which I think is more efficient anyway.
Mm-hmm. Every time I mention to someone that I've been tested or I plan to get tested, they always say to me, "Doctor, but those aren't even accurate. Like, why are you doing that?" And early on, that was the case, right? When we go back to March and April, how has testing evolved, and should we have confidence in them?
Well, I think that's a good question, Randall. I think the issue is there's no such thing as a perfect test. There's inaccuracy for any test that you have. You're trying to get better tests. And there's two ways we look at this. One is sensitivity and specificity. So it's really looking at the test's ability to correctly identify people that have the disease as well as people that do not have the disease. And they're usually not perfect. We try to get toward perfection. So as the testing modalities have evolved, we've gotten more accurate, but there's still some degree of uncertainty and misclassification built into any of the tests modalities here. There was an article that Jane Brody published, I think yesterday or the day before, which really talked about this, that you can still miss cases. There's the issue of missing cases, and that is having false negative results, which is a problem because you're not going to identify people that potentially could spread it. And that is a function, one, of the test itself, which may be imperfect, but also sometimes it's just you don't luck out in terms of getting the swab in the right place. Mm. And number three, there's the biologic variability for every person. You may not be shedding a lot of virus at the moment that they're doing the swab test, and maybe that kicks up, you know, a half day later. So you've got all these things that contribute to not necessarily having a perfect test result, which would allow you to, with certainty, say, here's what's going on.
Now, just for my own curiosity, because I know how you feel about the antibody tests, but I did go get one and it came back negative. Now, I was looking to see if a terrible virus that I had back in late February, early March could have been novel coronavirus. And I guess it still could have been, right, because those antibodies that my body created may have already left my system. I'm hearing there's like a 3-month window now that they've targeted.
Yeah, it's not that they've left your system, but when you have an antibody response to an infection, it's not constant. So you have to it takes a while to build up the antibodies, and the nature of the antibodies that are produced changes over time as well. There's an immediate onslaught of these antibodies that are called IgM, which show up sort of 2 or 3 days perhaps after infection, and they kind of disappear pretty quickly afterwards. And then IgG, another type of antibodies, that class of antibodies starts getting developed, and those provide longer term protection, we think. And it may also be that it's not the quantity of the antibody, but the fact that you develop specific subcomponents of antibodies that really are the things that protect you. We don't know enough right now. We're really trying to get the information about what are the protective elements of the antibodies you produce that are going to keep you out of trouble. And we don't know that right now. That's why we're doing some studies to look at cohorts of individuals that are infected and see what happens over time to see whether they have protective immunity, whether they're still capable of infecting other people. So we don't know. So you may have a very low antibody count, raw count, but it may be that you have plenty of that protective subcomponent that's there. We just don't know at this point.
And there is at least one benefit, right, to finding out who may have been infected in the past, because you can take their blood or their plasma, I guess, right, and use that as a treatment for people who are currently suffering from COVID-19?
Yes, there's a class of folks that have been infected that they do mount a fairly large antibody response. They can provide the sera that could be available for others. And that actually, it's very much like the passive immunity we've done for years when you had an IV immunoglobulin injection, right, for hepatitis in the old days. You're getting somebody else's antibodies, the antibodies there, that may protect you if you're sick. And so this sera has been available now, and it's not widely available, but not everybody who's infected, in fact, and recovers even, will necessarily mount a large quantitative response. So not everybody is necessarily a appropriate donor who's recovered. You have to sort of screen people for that.
All right, Dr. President Donald Trump tweeted out this morning, great news on vaccines, with no other follow-up data. Is this likely over Moderna's potential vaccine that is heading into the final stage of testing?
Well, I don't know what he was referring to. Clearly, they're in phase three. They're starting their phase three tests right now, Moderna. There are other candidate vaccines that are in trials now, and they're moving toward these larger phase three trials. These are very large trials that may involve 30 to 60,000 individuals to see whether they're effective or not. So it does take time to do this. But, you know, I would say that we have made great progress in vaccine development. The government is planning to put into production maybe 5 or 6 candidate vaccines prior to knowing which one is going to be the best one. And they're doing that so that when we do discover the best vaccine, we will already have some stockpile there. So it's an unusual move, and it's a very expensive move because you're essentially going to be supporting the production of 3 or 4 or 5 other vaccines, which aren't going to be the ones that get deployed.
Just to give people a sense of vaccine timelines, this is a rapid rate compared to anything we've seen in the past.
Absolutely. This is unprecedented to see this level of vaccine development from the start of a novel approach to doing the vaccine to creation of a test product to phase one and phase two. So, I mean, this timeline has been so accelerated, which is great. Part of that's a result of the money and resources that have been spent on this, but also part of it's the technology. We know a lot more about immunology than we did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So we have a lot more laboratory and methodological approaches that can be deployed now that weren't available back then. But it's a combination of an all-out effort, I think, to sort of do this this, and also mobilizing the clinical research apparatus that's needed to actually do these vaccine trials. You know, it's not easy to do a clinical trial with 20,000, 30,000, 60,000 people. So I think that also has moved along much greater in the last 20 years, particularly with the investments the National Institutes of Health have done to shore up the clinical translational research infrastructure in this country. I think that's really contributed to this.
In news stories, we've pretty much dropped the word novel, but it is called the novel coronavirus for a reason. It's a new one because there's old ones, and we've been studying those, and that helps as well, right? We already sort of have a leg up on how coronavirus work. I don't know what the plural is, coronavirus.
Yeah, we do. It's a little bit of a leg up, but you know, this virus, this coronavirus, is not like the other ones. It's not like the original SARS or MERS. It's not like the more common cold viruses that we see. So we know a lot about sort of the biology of the virus, but it's not. It just is just working a little bit differently. There's no seasonal component to the epidemic, which is something that was more characteristic of other coronaviruses. So, you know, it's novel. It's different. There's some similarities. It's helped us certainly in terms of the approaches we're taking now with therapeutics, of course, as well as for vaccine prevention. But we're still a lot we don't know, obviously, and that's why we're doing research.
What are you thinking in terms of, I know everybody wants a timeline, right? What are we thinking in terms of when we can somewhat get back to normal because there might be a virus or some viable treatment?
Yeah, well, I haven't put my bets down at Harrah's in Reno, but
right.
You know, it's very difficult. I mean, I know you see people hedging their bets and so on. I think Dr. Fauci may be right. I think we may identify a very good candidate vaccine by the first quarter of next year. And then there's the issue of actually getting, if we've done that, is getting it distributed. You know, it's not easy to launch a new vaccination program. And this is even getting around the issue of some folks that are the anti-vaxxers that wouldn't do this regardless. But having a large-scale vaccine available is going to be important. I know I do a lot of global health. I am grounded. I will not get on an airplane until I am vaccinated, until I have an effective vaccine. So I'm not counting on really traveling globally until a year from now. I think that, you know, that would be optimistic, but I think that may be the case, that by July of next year, we will have the vaccine. We will have a vaccine. We will start deploying it. And I think once it's deployed, then there'll be some protection there. It may not be perfect. We don't know. It may not be quite as bad as influenza, which changes every year and has to be, you have to be revaccinated all the time. But we don't know yet how effective the vaccine is going to be. But certainly, if it takes the edge off the mortality issues and the severe disease we have, that'll be important. The other last thing I'll say is, you know, we're also working on therapeutics. So let's forget about the prevention part of this for a second. If we develop really effective therapies where we can guarantee that we'll have 1 in a million deaths related to people that are infected, that's also going to change the complexion of what we do and how we view this epidemic. So I think both of those are important. And there's a lot of work going on with therapeutics right now. I know at UC Davis, we've been involved in the remdesivir trial. Lots of therapies that are being tested right now. You heard about the discovery at Oxford University where they found steroid therapy, dexamethasone, was used to sort of really take the edge off of some of the mortality. So there's a lot of these things that are coming along now. There's a second trial going on with remdesivir and another agent versus remdesivir alone. And so I think some of these results will be perhaps coming out a lot sooner than when we've discovered the vaccine. So I think those are going to be important also.
I want to leave it on the bright spot because you just gave us something to be hopeful for. Dr. Brad Pollack, the Associate Dean for Public Health Sciences at the UC Davis School of Medicine. It is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks, Randall.
Mm-hmm. Up next, after reaching historic lows, California's unemployment rate has shot up to historic highs, and that's expected to jump again as the state pushes deeper into shutdown mode. We'll speak with an expert who can help us understand the current situation and get some tips for those who again find themselves out of a job. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
And a welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Unemployment numbers hit record levels in California this past spring, and with the further shutdown of the service sector, jobs announced back on Monday, we can expect those numbers to climb back into at least record territory. Jennifer Shaw is the president of the Shaw Law Group and an expert in employment law. And if you've heard her on Insight in the past, you know she's good at answering tough questions. So we'll get right to it. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hi, Randall. Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. Hey, so Jennifer, the LA Times posted a story this week that highlighted really horror stories of filing unemployment claims, including a man who's quoted as saying it takes 150 redials to get through to the Employment Development Department, or the EDD. Do you have some life hacks for avoiding this?
Oh my gosh, I sure wish I did. Here's the deal. There are a lot of horror stories out there, but there's also some good news out there in terms of the EDD has really staffed up. They are doing a lot to reply to the Ask EDD. It's sort of a network that you can get through. It's kind of an email address, but better than an email address. And they're responding. They're doing a great job. So I think it's definitely getting better, but those nightmare stories are still out there.
So if you're feeling frustrated by using the phone, try this other method.
Correct. So if you just Google Ask EDD, you'll see the link. You can type in what your issue is. There's some drop-down menus. Definitely helps.
Nice. Okay. So that was a life hack. Right? So one of the problems, I guess, that's facing people are just some common mistakes that can slow down the benefits process. What might some of those be?
So one of the things that employees really need to understand when they're going to apply for these benefits is that they've got to have all their information available and upfront. So they need to know things like how much money have they made in the current calendar year. They've got to be able to really explain what the circumstances are. To be honest, it's not the easiest interface when you get on the website. There are a lot of pull-down menus and a lot of things you have to try to figure out. So one of the things I tell people is just please try to think about having as much as you can right in front of you. And if you have a question, you can always exit out of the system and come back. It's actually worth the time and energy to get it right the first time, because what happens is once you make a mistake, you get routed into this queue of people who made mistakes, and it's taking a while to get through that queue. Rather than if you just exit out of the system, you can get right back in where you left off. So you can jot things down. I wish it were possible to go through the program before you had to put in the information so you could actually see what you needed.
Oh, right.
And they're always updating the program. So, it's not really possible for us to go through each category. But that's a really important thing for people to do.
There's a whole group of people that were unemployed and then, you know, big portions of the service sector reopened and they went back to work. And now big sectors of the service sector are closing and they're out of a job again. So they won't be filing for the first time this year anyway. Is there a difference between whether this is your first time trying to get unemployment or whether you were just on it?
Yes, there is a difference, Randall, and it's really important for people who are receiving benefits. When they go in to report their status each week, one of the options is to say, I did a little work this week, but I still don't have a regular job. That is what everybody should be saying, unless they are 100% clear, for example, that they're in an essential business, and so they will get to continue working. So anybody who's worked in restaurant, hospitality, like you said, the service industry, They need to remember that each week is sort of a gift at this point. So they should be looking at this as, yes, I worked this week, but I'm not closing my claim. Now, if they did it already, it's fine. When once they get back online, the system will know that they received benefits a month ago or a couple of weeks ago, and they will reinitiate. One of the sort of bugaboos in the system right now, though, is that if somebody applied a month ago and for whatever reason their claim hasn't been processed, maybe there's been an error, something's going on, that is going to delay them to get the new benefits as well. So it's really important to be sure that we are staying on top of our profiles on the EDD. There's actually an EDD profile that every benefit recipient has. So we can make sure that if they're looking at that all the time, they'll be putting in the right information.
Right. Jennifer, what if you're self-employed or, you know, you're a gig worker? Does that make it easier, harder to get benefits?
Well, actually, now with COVID, there actually are benefits where those individuals didn't used to get them, right?
Right.
So that's the good news. The bad news is that many folks who are gig workers also have regular jobs. So they've tried to apply for benefits when they haven't lost their, quote, regular job, their job as an employee. And that's really confused a bunch of things in the EDD process. So they're definitely eligible. They should apply, but they may have to go back a couple of times to make clear what their situation is.
So we don't want to think about this, at least for the people that this would affect. But what if your application for benefits gets denied? What do you do there?
That happens, and the good news is you have an appeal process, and the EDD will send you a letter either via mail or email explaining what your appeal process is. The most important thing I tell everybody is watch your email, watch your mail, make sure you don't miss something, because there are very strict time frames during which you have to make those appeals, so you don't want to miss those time frames.
What if you don't feel safe going back to work? You know, your employer says it's totally fine. We need you here. But you're like, I've been there and I don't see safety measures in place. How does that work when it comes to unemployment?
Well, it's interesting. You will be eligible for unemployment if you have a legitimate reason to not go to work. And one legitimate reason might be that I'm fearful. Now, one of the things that has been made pretty clear over the last couple of months is that it's not enough to just have this generalized anxiety, for example. You really have to have a legitimate reason why you think your organization is not doing what they need to be doing to stay safe. And honestly, I tell all of my clients, I want you to assume that your employee is going to call OSHA if you don't do this correctly. We all have to have integrity in this process and make sure we're doing everything we need to be doing. So if somebody feels like their employer is not doing what they need to be doing, they absolutely have a right to not go to work. And they should let the employer know, not just, I don't feel safe, but listen, I've noticed we don't have hand sanitizer. Why aren't people wearing masks? What's going on? You know, our office is wearing masks, but I see people in the building all day long who don't have a mask on. What can we do about that? One of the things I've talked a lot about during this crisis is just having a little bit of grace, not assuming the worst, but trying to actually give people the benefit of the doubt, no matter who we are. So rather than getting upset with the employer, trying to say, hey, this is something you might not have thought about. And the employer may have a very good explanation for what they're doing, but that dialogue will help. If the employee decides that, in fact, they can't work, they don't feel safe, they apply for benefits, the EDD will ask them what kind of steps they've taken to try to deal with the situation. So it's very beneficial for them to do that.
Jennifer, I think you'd make just a great life coach.
Oh, you're so sweet.
beyond just what we're talking about here. Hey, so we asked people to tweet to us, and you might have to explain this question to me, Jennifer, but sure. American B-Boy says, I'd like to point out that the legacy mainframe platform that hosts EDD data has never been the problem. It's always been a front-end application. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. And one of the things I'm really sensitive about when I talk about this issue is I think the EDD has done an amazing job dealing with what is an unprecedented volume of emails, applications. So I don't want anyone listening to think I'm criticizing the EDD. They have done a great job. But listen, being a state agency, there are a number of requirements they have to go through to get certain platforms, to get certain technology. And so sometimes it's not as easy to update a government infrastructure as it would be to update something that's private sector. So I think what the caller is actually, or the listener is actually referring to, is there is some front end technology and also just some human error that can happen right. with this situation that we sort of also want to have a little grace with. And that's why that Ask EDD function is so great, because you can say, hey, listen, you know, it looks like you processed my claim, but this is what I don't have. And it's really a way to have a dialogue, because the person quoted in the LA Times is 100% right. Your chance of getting someone on the phone is very, very small. I mean, you probably have a better chance of winning the lottery. So because of that, rather than being frustrated and spending all of that time and energy, I found that the Ask EDD function is really a lot better.
Where are we in terms of getting benefit extensions? Because I had heard that a lot of this runs out at the end of July.
Well, here's what runs out, Randall, and it's really important. It's not the state's unemployment benefits. It's the extra $600 that the federal government has been kicking in for anyone who's eligible for $1 of state unemployment, which, of course, has been a lifesaver, because we're talking about adding, you know, $2,400 or more every month to people's income. Of course, politics is involved, and we're not going to get into that today. No. But the bottom line is there's not a lot of agreement on whether they should extend what's called the HEROES Act, which is what gave us unemployment in the first place at the $600 level. So the current $600 benefit is due to expire July 31st. I really think that with the current, whether you call it a surge or a second wave, I'm not sure what the medical term is, whatever's going on, it's a hot mess right now. I'm just hoping that Congress can see that this is a real lifesaver, I mean, literally, for folks who need to work, who need benefits, who need to take care of their family. I'm hoping they will extend. I've talked to our local representatives who seem to think there's a real good chance. Also, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is actually supporting an extension. So I think a lot of people are trying to be on the same page here and really focus on what's good for the community. So I have my fingers crossed.
All right. Jennifer Shaw, she's the president of Shaw Law Group and an expert in employment law and just an all-around life coach. So, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us again.
Randall, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Up next, why the economic fallout from COVID-19 is hitting some communities much harder than others, and how long the recovery there could take. I'm Randall White. You're listening to Insight right here on Cap Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Almost half of the Sacramento residents who responded to a Cap Radio Valley Vision survey said they lost income due to the COVID-19 pandemic. While it may not come as a shock that so many have lost jobs due to shutdowns, the survey showed that income loss was higher within communities of color. And here to talk about the results of this survey and how income loss has affected Sacramento area residents is Cap Radio reporter Pauline Bartoloni and Saba Wahid, a labor expert and research director at the UCLA Labor Center. And welcome to you both. Great to have you here this morning.
Hi, Randall.
Thank you for having us.
We should also mention that the results of this poll are available on our website. I'll remind you again at the end of the interview here, but it's capradio.org/poll, P-O-L-L. So it's really simple, capradio.org/poll. Pauline, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the survey said regarding income losses? What or who exactly is affected?
Sure. Yeah. So Cap Radio paired up with Valley Vision, a nonprofit here, and we polled folks in the 8-county greater Sacramento region. So that's folks from San Joaquin all the way up to Yuba-Sutter, folks in the foothills. And respondents, about 45% of people said that their income has gone down somewhat or significantly. But if you take a closer look at those numbers, the racial breakdowns, you'll see there's a pretty big difference in the financial hardship that's playing out. So about 62% of Black and Latino folks said that their income has gone down, 53% of Asian folks. And if you look at white residents, actually their income loss was a little bit less than the average, about 39%.
All right. And Pauline, I'm going to start with you on this, but I know Subba has a lot to say here. Why have communities of color been hit harder with this?
Yeah, I talked to an economist about this, and you know, they said a lot of the job losses have been in sectors that employ a lot of folks of color. So retail, hospitality, entertainment, restaurants. And then you have small business owners who have fewer customers, just fewer commerce overall.
Mm-hmm. And then Subba, I'm going to have you follow up there.
Yeah, I would just expand, because those are absolutely the reasons why you see that disproportionate impact. I mean, when you kind of step back and just think about what the options were for workers, like either you could work from home, and already there's a racial disparity in terms of who can work from home. So white workers are much more likely than Black and Latinx workers to be working from home. You could continue working, which were often the essential jobs, which are often the more like riskier, you know, possible exposure kind of jobs. And those are also by Black and Latino workers.
Frontline workers,
the essential workers, the ones in the grocery stores, the, you know, driving the taxis or working in the healthcare industries. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the last option was that you would lose your job. And, you know, taking away the other, basically, if you couldn't work, you know, if you weren't a frontline worker, you were most likely working in an industry where your industry either shut down or it reduced clientele. And so, remote workers would be folks like finance, management, business jobs, whereas the non-remote jobs would be like the hotels, which immediately shut down, the restaurants, which downsized, transportation, retail, construction, education, and health services. And a lot of those jobs lost work, and a lot of those were Black and people of color jobs.
Mm-hmm. Subba, you're based in L.A.?
We are based in L.A., yes, from UCLA.
So this survey was done in the greater Sacramento region, as Pauline explained, but this disparity is not just happening here, right? We're seeing it statewide and where you are in LA?
LA, California, nationally. Uh-huh. The numbers are exactly the same no matter what level you look at it, which comes to the fact that some of this stuff is structural. Like, it's not just COVID that created these problems. It's all, you know, we see this in all kinds of cases around COVID. COVID just shined a light on some of the issues that existed before. Who are the people in the low-wage jobs? Who are the people who are more vulnerable in their jobs in terms of having stability? Who are the ones that are in higher career ladder jobs? You know, so a lot of that breaks down by race. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of kind of racial awareness. And so you can go back to the last recession. Who experienced the largest unemployment? It was Black workers, double those of white workers. You're seeing that again in the COVID response. So some of the issues weren't resolved then are showing up again, and they're showing up more extreme.
And we saw it with the housing collapse as well. The people more likely to have lost their home and had one of those risky loans were people of color. So it continues to go back, and a lot of these issues pointed out directly coinciding, you know, the George Floyd protests, like you said, shining a light on some of these issues right now. So, Pauline, you looked into how well people will be able to bounce back from some of these economic losses. And what did you find there?
Yeah, so I was really curious about if people are going to be able to recover and when from some of these economic losses. Is this a permanent decline in income? And I talked to labor researcher Ken Jacobs at UC Berkeley about this. And he said, especially with COVID surging again, it will likely take much longer to recover economically. You know, you're going to see more businesses close because of all the contractions and opening back up again. And of course, when businesses close, workers, employees are affected. And he said that it could actually result in more permanent changes and what kind of jobs come back. And so here's what he had to say about that.
Do we see a greater use of technology? Because in industries where robots didn't make economic sense 6 months ago, they might make economic sense because they can be used in ways that don't create COVID risks. So we could see some quicker economic transformations than economists had expected prior to this crisis.
So you hear he's kind of hinting at automation. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe some jobs that existed 6 months ago may not exist again in 2 years. We'll see if some of that plays out.
Yeah. So, but what are your thoughts on this? Will people be able to go back to the income levels they had before?
If we, again, look at, you know, past recessions, if you look at the 2007 to 2010 recession, two things happened. One was that a lot of higher paying jobs were replaced by lower paying and temporary jobs. That is when the gig economy, like doing things like rideshares and Airbnb, all of those emerged. So I think what Ken is saying is exactly right. Like there, it could get worse, you know, in terms of what the economy will bring back. Or if we take a more intentional and concerted effort to bring back, when we bring back the economy, let's bring back better jobs at better wages. And so it's a little bit of like policy making and decisions. The other thing I want to note, the other thing that happened is that it was harder, like Black and people of color communities, it took them longer to come back from recession. So you have to apply a racial equity lens when we're thinking about job recovery.
So you foresee that there will likely be permanent changes to the job market because of COVID, but there are ways to avoid that.
If we have some strong policy making and we really think about, you know, how we want to bring these jobs back, you know, I want to go back to this comment that Pauline said about small businesses. So there's a ripple effect that's happening where if you don't have money in your pocket, you're not going to your local business, which may be, if you're in a Black neighborhood, a Black owned or a Latino owned business. And so when you're losing small businesses and then you're replacing them with like big businesses, you know, and you get more corporate centered businesses who often are not practicing great labor, that don't have great labor practices, are we going to address those issues? Are we going to let, you know, these bigger companies kind of take over and rule the market? Or are we going to push for the small businesses? Are we going to provide resources? Are we going to make sure that there's labor standards in place and protections? All of these things can happen. And then we will bring an economy that's stronger and that's more fair.
Right. And Pauline, you talked to a small business owner affected by COVID, and he actually had some positive things to say about this time. Can you tell us about what you found?
Yeah, that was kind of inspiring that he had a kind of a positive outlook on things. His name's Kevin Lash. He owns Rap-A-Lot Specialty Films in North Sacramento's Del Paso region. That basically he does like fancy car detailing, window tinting. He puts film decoration on boats and makes jerseys for school athletes. And he says business has been down 40%. And what hurts him most is the inability to network at community events, because he says that's where he meets clients. That's where he meets people who need stuff done to their cars or whatnot. But he surprisingly said that the pandemic has given him time to kind of rethink his business model and pivot and get creative. Basically, here's how he described it.
It allowed me to kind of be creative in my business. If one wasn't working, I, you know, kind of create another service or have another service that allows me to kind of pivot and, you know, and focus over there. So in my industry, I'm normally printing T-shirts and stuff and then, or wrapping a vehicle, but then I'm now allowed to, you know, never thought that I would get into the signage.
Yeah, and I did want to point out that in the poll, the Cap Radio Valley Vision poll, we did hear that from respondents. They're saying they're enjoying the time to rethink their priorities and the slower pace.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Saba? Have you heard any positive stories like the one Pauline just showed us?
Some of the small businesses we've been talking to are having a harder time. So, for example, we just did a survey with nail salons, workers and owners, and they're really struggling because a lot of them didn't have, they got completely shut down. So they didn't have the recourse to be able to continue to pay rent. They definitely could not keep paying their workers. So, some of those have been harder, and those are like some of the at-risk businesses, like who will be able to sustain it and come back. Mm-hmm. I love that idea that it's a moment to reset and there's space. But at the same time, there's this pressure of opening and getting income and getting people back through the door. It's exciting, and it's also really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Could there be some sort of silver lining, Saba?
I think that, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, is that if this can be a moment for us to really think about the things that became visible, mm-hmm, in terms of some of the unfairness in our economic systems, yes. I really think this is an opportunity for us to rethink our systems, rethink race, rethink low wage work, rethink labor protections.
So, Pauline, everything we've been talking about is based on this Cap Radio Valley Vision poll. And with all the data that's in there, it spurs a lot of stories. Mm-hmm. So what else can we expect to hear out of this series?
Yeah, we're probably going to have another week of stories. Tomorrow, Sarah Mises Tan is doing a piece about how white folks are faring better on a number of measures during COVID. But this week, we really focus on the racial disparities. Next week, we're talking about other interesting findings in the poll, like how people in the Sacramento area resoundingly said they want to continue working at home even after the pandemic and it's safe to go back to the office. So we look forward to that story on Monday.
All right. Cap Radio reporter Pauline Bartoloni and Saba Wahid, a labor expert and research director at the UCLA Labor Center. Thank you to you both. Very enlightening.
Thanks, Randall.
Mm-hmm. And again, you can find all of that information there at capradio.org/poll. That's the Cap Radio Valley Vision poll in the details there. And we'll have another show again for you tomorrow. I'm Randall White. This is Insight. Thanks for joining us today.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.